Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we are going to discuss a $1 billion question. Is globalization dead? Joining me to try to answer this is Uri Dadush, who is a senior fellow here at Bruegel and is connecting with us from Miami, in the other side of the Atlantic. Hi, Uri. Thanks for joining The Sound of Economics. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Giuseppe, how are you doing?
Very good. I hope that in Miami the weather is better than Brussels at the moment.
No question about that.
So, speaking about the weather and cold weather, a couple of weeks ago at the World Economic Forum in Davos, the talk of the town was that globalization isn't inevitable, despite what we were told by politicians and economists in the 1990s. A chorus that was joined in the Alpine location by Germany's Prime Minister Olaf Scholz, who warned against the danger of deglobalization that hung like a sword of Damocles over the world. To give everyone a little bit of context, deglobalization would mean that most countries become progressively less connected through all or most channels: trading goods, trading services, capital flows, movement of people, and the transfer of technology. Such a process would mark a U-turn of economic trends that prevailed over at least the last 150 years, interrupted only by world wars and depression. There are several questions which are linked to the topic, and I would like to break them down for our listeners before discussing them with you, Uri. So firstly, are we really seeing a fragmentation of the world economy, and which could be the indicators to measure such process if it's really happening? Secondly, how this relates to the revival of protectionist policies across the various regions of the world? Thirdly, is the political rivalry overshadowing the rational economic argument for globalization? And last but not least, what is the new world that is emerging? What to expect from the regionalization of value chains, the delocalization of manufacturing, and the green transition? I know those are quite a batch of questions, and we could dedicate a whole series of our podcast about it, but let's try to walk us through all these things and have a look at them. So let's start from the overarching issue, Uri. Are we witnessing a shift from hyper-globalization to deglobalization?
Yeah, Giuseppe, thank you. Well, of course, this is based on my article on the Bruegel site. The answer to your question, in short, is no. We certainly have had hyper-globalization. We certainly are seeing slower globalization than in the past, but we don't see deglobalization the way you have defined it. Let me elaborate a little bit. The hyperglobalization period, roughly 1985 to the global financial crisis in 2005-2007, was an absolutely extraordinary period without a historical precedent due to the joining in world markets of China, Russia, India, etc., as they changed their policies, and also various technological developments, the most important of which probably was the container and then subsequently the internet. And of course, it was associated with trade liberalization. That was an extraordinary period. And in a sense, what we're witnessing now is a return to something more normal along historical lines, where globalization proceeds at a much more, let's say, stately pace. If you look at the last 10 years, 15 years since the financial crisis, you can see that the slow, and this is in my article and in a number of other places, is that slower globalization has been associated with slower economic growth, especially in China, and especially as slower economic growth affected the prices of primary commodities, especially oil demand and oil prices. This reduced the rate of progression of world trade, disproportionately compared to GDP. However, globalization is continuing in many ways and in many places. You see it in services, you see it in migration, and of course you see it in the boom in information and technology flows as the number of people using the internet over the last 15 years has gone up from about 20% in the world to 60%. Even in goods where you clearly see a decline in the trade to GDP ratio, the fact is that the integration of global production chains continues at a similar pace to the hyper-globalization periods in many places, especially, I would say, not especially, but including in the EU and even in the US. There has been a very big change in China, which has become more oriented towards domestic demand. And as I show in my article, if you exclude oil exporters, most countries have seen rising merchandise trade to GDP ratios since the financial crisis. Last but not least, and I'll end there, the big exception is capital flows, but mainly those among advanced economies, which have slowed dramatically since the global financial crisis. In a way, this is not surprising, because that's what the global financial crisis was about, and the advanced countries, the United States, Europe, were at the epicenter of the financial crisis, and the capital flows have suffered in a major way. But overall, one cannot speak of deglobalization.
Thank you, Uri. I mean, you're making it quite clear that by all means, there is somehow a rhetoric on the table which speaks about globalization, but actually the indicators say something that is quite different. And many attribute this rhetoric to deglobalization, to the advance of protectionism within the political realm. We've been seeing in the last 5 years or more events such as Brexit, the United States abandonment of TPP under President Trump, the China-US trade war, the disabling of the WTO's dispute settlement systems, the pandemic's disruption of global supply chains, and many calls for self-reliance. Last but not least, the trade sanctions imposed on Russia following its invasion of Ukraine added evidence that global economic integration is being challenged. How would you read those tendencies against the evidence of the fact that such indicators don't show an actual deglobalization on the ground?
Giuseppe, this is the reason I wrote the article. I am a trade economist, and I'm extremely concerned about the geopolitical orientation of the present and evident protectionism that you see in a number of places. And you have cited the most important incident of protectionism. And so I wanted to find out for myself whether protectionism was a significant or major contributor to the slowdown in globalization, particularly of trading goods that we have seen. And my conclusion is no. My conclusion, this is on the data up to the moment that I wrote the article that was available back in November of 2022. Based on that data, my conclusion is that protectionism did not play a major role or even overall a significant role in the slowdown of world trade, world trading goods in particular. That was my focus since the global financial crisis. And that is because all of the examples that you cited, dramatic as they are offset by other trends, in particular, the spread of regional trading arrangements and the enactment of the coming into force of big mega regionals. Okay, I'm referring to RCEP, I'm referring to the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, CPTPP, and the renewal of NAFTA in the form of USMCA. These regional agreements now cover approximately two-thirds of world trade, whereas 20 years ago, they covered about 60% of world trade. But more important than the trade coverage of these mega regionals and regional arrangements is the fact that many of them have become deeper. Yeah, they become more reciprocal. They have become they cover more ground. They go deeper into disciplines, etc., etc. Of course, the EU has been a major driver of these agreements, and the EU itself is the single most important mega region, I would say. Some other factors contribute to the liberalization. For example, China, which is now the larger exporter of goods, and I think the second largest importer of goods, has reduced its tariffs and also has liberalized its foreign investment regime considerably in the last several years. Also worth noting is the fact that some of the examples you mentioned, like the China-US trade war and the trade sanctions on Russia, tend to redirect trade, not eliminate it. So when you look at trade aggregates, what you see is that instead of importing from China, the United States imports from Vietnam or Bangladesh. So that's part of the explanation, which means, of course, that trade has become less efficient. But nevertheless, it doesn't mean that globalization has stopped or trade has stopped.
Sorry, Uri, let me stress a little bit this point because it is important to understand for our listeners as well what exactly is your point of view here. If I understand correctly, you're saying, yes, there are all these disruptions of the business as usual that we've been seeing so far, but these disruptions refer to specific relations within the system, but they are just reconfiguring the relations within the global system elsewhere. So the sum of the game, it's still increasing the overall exchange between countries at global level, even if those exchanges are changing their nature or their geography in terms of networks that are connected with each other. Is that exactly what you're saying?
Yes, that is what I'm saying. And studies, for example, show using complex models, which you always have to take with a pinch of salt, by the way, but I think the basic message is correct. So one study shows that the whole of the China-US trade war, which affects, by the way, somewhere between just 2% of world trade, that the negative welfare effects of the China-US trade war are more than offset by a combination of RCEP, the trade agreement in Asia, and CPTPP, the successor to the TPP. You take those two agreements together, they more than offset. The welfare gains from those more than offset the welfare losses from the China-US trade war. And yes, there are sanctions imposed on Russia, but you know, Russia is not a big player in world trade. Essentially, it exports oil and gas, and it continues largely to export, but at a lower price. Russia and Ukraine together represent a very small part of world trade, and they're not integrated in global value chains. The same could be said of sanctions on Iran, for example.
And one additional question, because of course this is all related to the geopolitical rivalry and the gap. I mean, somehow it seems that there is a gap between the high rhetorics on decoupling and the intricate reality on the ground, if I understand correctly. You've seen that only 2% of the world trade has been affected by the China-US trade war. My follow-up question is, do you have any even rough idea about what kind of percentage of the actual trade between the US and China has been disrupted by the trade war between the US and China itself?
Well, the 2% that I quoted, maybe it's a little above 2% of world trade, is the trade between the US and China that has been affected by tariffs.
Okay, so that's minimal.
Yeah, it's a small part of world trade. I mean, part of what's going on, Giuseppe, is that the world economy is just much bigger than many people think and has become much more integrated in recent years than many people understand. And yes, China and the U.S. are big economies, and there's a lot of trade between them. But in a global context, including, by the way, just referring to the size of the Chinese and the U.S. economies, the trade between the two is a very small part of these giant economies. Realize that. And so the welfare effect, for example, on the United States of the China-U.S. trade war, if you like, the equivalent income reduction as a result of the inefficiency is far less than 1% of U.S. GDP. If I remember correctly, the number is about 0.04%, so less than 0.5%, even less than that, I think. So, yeah, that's part of what's going on. It's just the immense size of the global economy.
So somehow, I mean, your view, because of course we've been seeing that there's quite more pessimistic approaches around, but it seems that the glass is not that much half empty. It seems that it's quite half full on the other side. I would perhaps also try to delve into another related topic, speaking of more of a positive approach about what's going on. And this reconfiguration of trade routes and not only trade routes, but the value chains and so on. We've been seeing that emerging markets in Latin America, Africa and Asia, I mean, you mentioned that, are building regional production networks for crucial goods. And there is also, let's say, maybe a positive effect in all this in creating more resilient trade pathways and new development models that aren't entirely pinned to exporting cheap goods to a handful of nations across long transport routes that are becoming more expensive and politically contentious. So, I mean, we are kind of seeing everywhere decentralized technologies, and the use of technology like big data is kind of allowing more local for local production, something that may end up also being good for the planet. So we've been speaking about 3D printed homes, or other solutions for either adaptation when it comes to climate, like housing solutions for in disaster zones, but actually also other solutions for other problems such as inflation. Perhaps we can say that this new world isn't completely bad, neither completely good. It's just different, and it would be interesting to hear what you think in terms of what this new world that is emerging is looking like, what to expect from the regionalization of value chains, the delocalization of manufacturing, and somehow the linked theme of the green transition as it is attached to these topics.
Yeah. So, well, you put in a lot in that question.
Yeah, it's a lot on the fire, I know.
Yeah, let me deal first with the regionalization issue. The first point is that so far we are seeing very little regionalization. It's simply not in the numbers. I'm as aware as anybody is that CEOs are thinking about their value chains, how to make them more resilient, how to reduce risk, et cetera, et cetera. And like many others, I expect that there will be some moves in this direction at the margin. But we are just at the beginning of this process. And so far, very little of it is seen in the data. One example where it is likely to happen quite fast is not actually due to the response of the private sector, but to government subsidies, and that's in the semiconductor area, very simply because in a decision a government decision to put in huge amounts of money, rightly or wrongly, in the domestic production of semiconductors, particularly in the United States, but also in other places. So you'll see it there, and you'll probably see it at the margin going forward in other contexts. But so far, that development is limited. Now, let me underscore, I'm not complacent about this. If we have a worsening of the geopolitical picture, which is quite possible, particularly between the United States and China, and at the same time, rules of the multilateral trading system become increasingly eroded because now the appellate body is no longer functioning. It's much more difficult now to enforce WTO rules than it was just a few years ago. If that continues, and as I said, the geopolitics gets worse, then it is even likely that we will see more fragmentation and more regionalization of the global value chains, very simply because companies will realize that it's safer to produce, you know, in Mexico and Canada than to produce in China or, you know, even elsewhere in Asia, because there are very well-established rules. The same will apply within the European Union, for example. And that would be the direction we're going on present trends. But again, we're just at the beginning of that, and it's not evident in the numbers in a significant way. If it did happen, the regionalization and fragmentation, then obviously that would be a big loss of efficiency in the world, because most of world trade is across the regions of the world. It is not within the regions of the world, the European Union being a probable exception to that.
Speaking of what you just said about maybe localization of production being moved to other countries and so on, there are several narratives over there at the moment which are quite predominant. One is the whole reshoring narrative, especially in the US, saying manufacturing is coming back to the homeland. So either reshoring or friendshoring. So you're speaking about Mexico, for example, or any other country that would present less political risks. But then the other thing that we are actually seeing is companies, like, for example, American companies producing in China for the Chinese market rather than for the global market. So this is also another phenomena to be taken into consideration within the complex scheme of things. You know, it seems that all these movements are happening at the same time and all together. So it's not going to be just one movement that would define this new configuration of world trade or world economy, but rather a series of patterns of these three movements: reshoring, friendshoring, and localizing production for specific markets, which are going to have specific risks and somehow not depend on one only value chain, but several value chains.
Well, Giuseppe, you hit the nail on the head. I think that, of course, if companies decide to produce in China for China, that is regionalization, okay? It's just it's not the regionalization that U.S. policymakers or European policymakers wanted, yeah? Because they wanted to produce more in the U.S. and more in Europe. But the unintended effect of these policies could be exactly the opposite, and that is that you produce in China for China, or you produce in the U.S. for the U.S., etc. And therefore, you get regionalization in both ways. However, again, precisely because this is an unintended consequence, it will probably act as a brake, radical decoupling policies in the capitals around the world. They will realize, policymakers will realize that this is not only inefficient, it can be counterproductive if they're not careful. But again, what is evident is that it isn't the economic calculus that is going to be at the top of these considerations. It is becoming increasingly the geopolitical calculus. And just like countries go to war and devastate mutually their economies, which is, obviously an irrational act. However, it is justified for other reasons. And that's the big risk at the moment. But again, the reason I wrote the article is to see whether this was already happening. And my conclusion is, so far, it is not happening. We are still in time.
Thank you, Uri. And unfortunately, this is all the time we have for this discussion in this episode. But obviously, we will keep the conversation alive because that's the big topic of understanding where the world economy is going in the next future and near and medium term and long term. So we will come back to this in our series of podcasts, but also in our analysis by our scholars. I would like to invite our listeners to read the piece by Uri, who is linked in the show notes, as well as reminding that you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot, Uri, for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Giuseppe.
And thanks to our listeners for joining in The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.